Welcome, and thank you for making it through whatever exactly you call that is outside at this point. I don't know if it's snow, freezing rain, slush, whatever you want to call it. Okay, we are in week three of the strange story of Daniel and the story of the writing on the wall. This is a great story. The lesson we're going to get here is essentially a lesson in being a mensch. That's essentially what emerges from this chapter in the book of Daniel. It's Daniel chapter 5, and we'll be reading it, so you'll get to see it. And it's about a man by the name of Belshazzar. And we're going to talk about where he comes from and what he's all about. But if you take a look on your sheets at source number 1, this is actually a Purim source. Passage in the Talmud talking about the relationship between Vashti and Ahasuerus. So you remember, of course, Ahasuerus is the king of the Persian Empire. Vashti is his wife until she is not his wife anymore. He throws this massive party. She is invited to the party a little late. She's having her own party. And she gets the king really, really angry with the message that she sends him when she refuses to show up to the party. So the Talmud expands on what it was that she said. Apparently, it wasn't just that she said, "I'm not interested in coming to your party." She said something more than that. Now, the passage in the Talmud that we're looking at in source number 1 relates to a historical question that we're not getting into at all. But I'm just going to explain what the assumption is that the Talmud is making here. The Babylonians were the ones who destroyed the temple. They are the dominant empire in the region until the year 539 before the Common Era. The year 539 before the Common Era, according to the secular historical count, the Jewish tradition has a little bit of a different number, but it doesn't matter for our purposes. We're just going to call it 539 because putting a number on it is helpful. That's the ones. So in the year 539, the Persians and an assortment of allies defeat the Babylonians. And the first king of the Persian Empire post-defeat of the Babylonians is Cyrus the Great, also known as Cyrus the Second. We liked Cyrus. We've talked about Cyrus on other occasions. Koresh. And we talked about him last year when we did our Game of Thrones series. So Cyrus eventually passes away, and then there were kings after him named Darius, as well as Artaxerxes or Artaxasta, all sorts of interesting names of kings, and the Persians like to recycle the names of their kings, which makes it very confusing to figure out who is whom and which ones have different analogs in the biblical text. But the key point for us is that Ahasuerus, who is a Persian king, so he's after Cyrus, is married to a woman by the name of Vashti, presumably among his other wives, because this wasn't a monogamous type of a situation for Persian kings, as we know from the book of Esther. And Vashti, as the Talmud reads it here, is actually a descendant of the Babylonian kings, and she marries down, presumably for love. Meaning, Ahasuerus was not from some royal Persian line. He was actually a stable boy. Right? Nice. Like, you know, all the different stories that you have, you know, fairy tales and the like about the princess, and she marries some guy and makes him into a prince. Well, take a look at source number 1, and you find that she pulled rank on him when she refused to come to his party, which gives you a whole other understanding of the book of Esther, by the way, in terms of Ahasuerus and this complex that he has, his fear of being undermined, his fear of being shown to be a fool, because he's not legitimately there. He's only there because of his marriage to a woman of royal lineage. But that's more about the book of Esther than we're going to do right now. Take a look at number 1. The king was very angry. The Talmud asks, why was he so upset? And Rava, Talmudic sage, said, because Vashti sent the following message to him. Son of my father's stable boy, my father drank the equal of 1,000 men and was not intoxicated. And this man, Ahasuerus, becomes foolish in his wine. You, Ahasuerus, you can't hold your liquor. My father, he knew how to drink. Her father is Belshazzar. And what we're going, that's the idea here. And what we're going to find out is that Vashti's revisionist history notwithstanding, he's not so good at holding his drink. And in fact, he had something of a problem, as we will see. So we're going to talk about what his character was and how the drinking actually plays into it. Yes?
But the Midrash just picks that up, or they have some...
Which piece? That Vashti said this to him?
No, that Vashti is Belshazzar's daughter.
Right, so that's a longer piece in the Talmud about, you know, where this whole thing comes from, where Ahasuerus came from. That's a bigger issue. So what we're going to get out of this, though, is, as I said at the outset, a lesson in being a mensch. So, again, we are dealing here with a story which is... right before, the story that we're going to read is the story of Belshazzar, not the story of Ahasuerus and Vashti. So it's right before the Persians defeat the Babylonians. You are somewhere around the year 539 before the Common Era, according to the standard historical chronology. Midrashic chronology would put it as early 4th century before the Common Era.
What happened to Nebuchadnezzar?
Nebuchadnezzar is gone. The book of Daniel ends its account of Nebuchadnezzar with last week's story. It does not tell us about his death. It's not interested. We had the arc of Nebuchadnezzar, this 4-chapter arc from the first chapter in which he destroyed the temple, took the Jews captive as trophies and so on, until chapter 4 where he is taught a lesson regarding his arrogance, exit stage left, we're done with him. Chapter 5 introduces us to Belshazzar. Belshazzar is described in the portion we're going to read as the son of Nebuchadnezzar. However, other texts place him as later, because there's another king of Babylon named Evil-Merodach. Or if you write it out in English, it doesn't look good. It looks like evil, Merodach. It's not a statement about him. It's just that's his name, Evil. You know, your parents name you something and you're just stuck with it. So his name was Evil Merodach. He is in between the two of them. So that some say, Rashi says that Belshazzar and Evil Merodach were brothers. They're both sons of Nebuchadnezzar. Others suggest that Belshazzar is Nebuchadnezzar's grandson. Which makes sense, because Jeremiah predicted that we would be exiled and we would serve under 3 Babylonian kings. The 3 generations, it sounded like, of Babylonian kings. So it's Nebuchadnezzar, and then Evil-Merodach, and then Belshazzar. And you'll tell me, well then why is he called the son of Nebuchadnezzar? And the answer is, if you read any biblical text, you know that they like to sandwich the generations. Meaning that the text frequently will call grandchildren children. It just means the term son, daughter, whatever, just means descendant. And the term father, mother, whatever, means ancestor. It shouldn't be, we don't get hung up on it. It's not such an issue. In non-biblical texts, we find reference to a Belshazzar whose father is actually a Babylonian king by the name of Nabonides. And that, you know, adds complications to the matter, but it doesn't matter for our purposes. The bottom line is, Belshazzar is the king of the Babylonian Empire, it appears, or at least the head of their army. In our story, the one story where he appears in Tanakh, and he is doing what he does best, which is, he is having a party. However, the party happens to be on a particular occasion. And it's not his birthday. The party is, in fact, while his armies are at war with the Persians. One step further, it is the day before they're going to lose to the Persians. So he's having a party in the middle of a war. Which already tells you something about his character. This is his idea of a morale booster. So take a look at source number 2, please, which starts us off on this story. And it's literally right after we finished the previous chapter where you had Nebuchadnezzar conclude his letter. That's it. We're done with him. No interest in pursuing him. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for his 1,000 nobles. And in the presence of the 1,000, he drank wine. And that's the reference now that you understand from the Talmud. He is drinking, it says here in the translation that you see, he's drinking in the presence of 1,000. The words in the Aramaic, in the original, are v'lakavel alfa chamer shasei, which can mean in the presence of, but it could also mean what the Talmud implied here, which is he's matching them. They're drinking, he's drinking. They're drinking, he's drinking. He's drinking like 1,000 men are drinking. Under the influence of the wine, Belshazzar ordered the gold and silver vessels that his father, and again, could be grandfather, whatever, Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple at Jerusalem to be brought so that the king and his nobles, his consorts, and his concubines could drink from them. The golden vessels that had been taken out of the sanctuary of the house of God in Jerusalem were then brought, and the king, his nobles, his consorts, and his concubines drank from them. Continuing our style in the book of Daniel of repeating things over and over. Right. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Sounds a lot like his statue, no? Mm-hmm. With all the materials. Okay. So he makes a great big party. What is this party for? So I've already given you one idea about what this party is celebrating. It's not my invention. Rashi says this, Abarbanel says it, and long before Rashi and Abarbanel, Rashi writing in the 11th century, Abarbanel writing in the end of the 15th century, Josephus said it. Josephus, again, we talked about him, first century Common Era. Take a look at source number 3 in his Antiquities of the Jews. The throne came to Baltasar, also known as Belshazzar, who by the Babylonians was called Nabo-Andalus. Okay. Against him did Cyrus, the king of Persia, and Darius, the king of Media, make war. We're going to talk about Darius next week, God willing, and who he was and where he reigned. That's his own story. And when he was besieged in Babylon, there happened a wonderful and prodigious vision. He was sat down at supper in a large room. There were a great many vessels of silver, such as were made for royal entertainments. And he had with him his concubines and his friends. Whereupon he came to a resolution and commanded that those vessels of God which Nebuchadnezzar had plundered out of Jerusalem and had not made use of, but had put them into his own temple, should be brought out of that temple. He also grew so haughty as to proceed to use them in the midst of his cups, drinking out of them and blaspheming against God. So, he's doing this while he is under siege in Babylon. It's during the actual war. And it seems, if you read it that way, that what he's doing is he's trying to boost morale. Josephus does not say that explicitly, but that's what it sounds like. Stephen?
I see it as the opposite. Okay. I see if you're boosting morale, you're going out to the troops and standing in front of them, like in many movies, and they see the leader. I see this as the exact opposite, that he's drowning his mind in not facing the fact that he's losing.
Right, and to me, those are the same point.
Oh, they are.
Meaning, yes, there are brave leaders who will march out at the head of the troops and give a morale-boosting kind of a speech and put themselves on the line and all that, and then there's Belshazzar. And this is his idea of a morale booster. Don't worry, boys. Let's drink. Tonight we drink. Tomorrow we fight. Yeah, that kind of approach is what it sounds like. And I have to admit, I'm biased when I say it because I know the rest of the story. And we'll see if you agree with me by the time we get to the end. But to me, this is very much in character for him. However, the Talmud has another take on what's going on here. And it requires that we do some math. So I apologize in advance. I didn't ask people to bring scrap paper for this class. But I think we can get through it. Remember that Jeremiah predicted that we would be in exile for 70 years. That's his one of his best known predictions. And we even know that the Babylonians took his prediction seriously. Take a look at source number 5 before we come back to number 4. The word came to Jeremiah from the Lord. After Nebuzaradan, the chief of the guard, set him free at Ramah, to which he had taken him, chained in fetters among those from Jerusalem and Judah who were being exiled to Babylon. To unpack that in English, Nebuzaradan is the lead general of the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar. Jeremiah had been chained up by the Jews, and Nebuzaradan frees him from his chains. And then the chief of the guards, this Nebuzaradan, took charge of Jeremiah, and he said to him, "The Lord your God threatened this place with disaster. Now the Lord has brought it about. He has acted as he threatened, because you sinned against the Lord and did not obey him. That is why this has happened to you." In other words, they believe in the prophecies of Jeremiah. The Babylonians believe in those prophecies. So knowing that Jeremiah has made a 70-year prophecy, and knowing that Babylonians took Jeremiah seriously, this passage in the Talmud does a little math. So now go back to number 4. And it was, after 37 years from the exile of Jehoiachin, king of Yehuda, king of Judea, which had happened in the 8th year of Nebuchadnezzar, on the 25th day of the 12th month, Evil-Merodach, king of Babylon, raised the head of Jehoiachin, king of Yehuda, and took him out of prison. So, Jehoiachin, king of Judea, is the last of our kings. Next to last of our kings, I apologize. But that's the first Babylonian conquest of Jerusalem. They depose Jehoiachin, they appoint a new king in his place, Jehoiakim, Zedekiah. But that's the count that they're making here. The 8th year of Nebuchadnezzar is our starting point. 37 years later, Evil-Merodach frees Jehoiachin from prison. So he's in prison for 37 years, correct? So 8 and 37 is 45 years since Nebuchadnezzar had taken power. Tradition teaches that Evil-Merodach reigned for 23 years, and 2 years of Belshazzar, total 70. I don't know if that was entirely clear, so let me rephrase. Nebuchadnezzar takes the throne. 8 years later, he takes Jehoiachin captive. So the clock is ticking now on what Belshazzar thinks are the 70 years. Meaning Belshazzar believes the 70 years start from the beginning of King Nebuchadnezzar's reign. So he says, okay, 8 years in was when they deposed, effectively, King Jehoiachin and imprisoned him in Babylon. Then you have another 37 years, so that's 45. That's the beginning of Evil-Merodach's reign. Evil-Merodach reigns for 23 years. We know that by tradition, not by a particular biblical verse. That takes you to 68. And then Belshazzar is only king for 2 years before the Persians kill him. So that means that this feast is going on 7 years after Nebuchadnezzar came to power. So that's their math. That's the math that they're bringing in. They say, well, maybe that's why Belshazzar made his feast. Belshazzar said, now certainly they will not be redeemed. It's been 70 years and the Jews are still captives. I will take out the implements of the temple and use them. I'm going to show that the Jews are defeated. Thus Daniel said, you elevated yourself over the master of heaven. The implements of his house were brought before you. And that's part of what we're going to see in this chapter. But that is what he's doing. The Talmud is making an assumption based on his conduct at the feast. Not just the fact that he held a feast, and it was 70 years after the start of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, but the fact that he brought out the temple vessels. Why do that? Why did he bring out vessels from the Judean temple for a feast of his? Says the Talmud, because he wants to say, the Jews are truly defeated now, they're never coming out, and this is how we're going to celebrate that victory that occurred 70 years ago. 70 years ago, we won this war, we conquered them, and now that's been made final, and we are going to mark that great success. That's the idea. So that's what he thinks is going on, and that's why he makes the party, according to the Talmud. The truth of the matter is that the two ideas behind why he makes the party can go together. Meaning, he's fighting his war against the Persians. He's thinking to himself, this is Rabbi Yaakov Meidan makes this point, he's thinking to himself, it could be that God's plan as told to Jeremiah was that the Persians were going to defeat me in war and free the Jews, which is exactly what happened. But they think they're going to do this, and And I am making my feast in order to demonstrate that that's not going to come to pass. The 70 years are over. They are not redeemed. I'm bringing out their vessels in order to demonstrate we are going to defeat the Persians and the Jews are going to remain enslaved to us forever. You follow?
Yes.
That could be what's going on. Okay.
So then Daniel's comment is he rebuking you?
Yes. And we're going to see it when we see it in context. It'll be even more clear. So he drinks opposite 1,000, whether he's drinking with 1,000 officers or whether he is, as Vashti says, you know, matching them drink for drink. They note who's at the party. It's not just the king and his nobles, but also his consorts and his concubines. They are there as well. His queen is not there. We're going to find that out a little further along. Right, so not necessarily. It's the women who are in the harem. Right, so not necessarily, meaning there's a hierarchy of relationship with the king. Concubine is basically one step up from slave. That's more or less what a concubine is in history. The consorts are not described as being the queen. We know this because in the story we're going to meet his queen. She's not at the party. There's something else. Sorry? Okay. So, he's had a lot to drink when he did this, right? We said that he's already under the influence of the wine, Bitaim Chamra, in the Aramaic. Okay. One thing that we're meant to understand here is his use of the vessels of the temple is significant. And Daniel is indeed going to call him on that. The Talmud thinks he's doing it in order to celebrate the defeat of the Jews. How else could you read it?
He wants to humiliate them.
An attempt to humiliate the Jews? Maybe. What else?
Challenge to God?
Could be.
To their God.
Did you notice that we didn't say it explicitly yet. Oh, I'm going to hold the did you notice. But keep in mind what he's doing here with these vessels of the temple. It's going to matter. Let's go further. Number 6. Just then, okay, as he's drinking out of the vessels of the temple, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand so that the king could see the hand as it wrote, right? Give him the benefit of proper lighting. The king's face darkened and his thoughts alarmed him. The joints of his loins were loosened and his knees knocked together. Yes, knees knocking together is a biblical thing, as apparently is writing on the wall. The king called loudly for the exorcists, Chaldeans, and diviners to be brought. Again, as I said last week when we saw this phrase, it doesn't necessarily mean exorcists the way you're thinking of it. The ashpaya, the ashaf, is the term that's used in the Aramaic. It means magicians of some kind. The king addressed the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever can read this writing and tell me its meaning shall be clothed in purple and wear a golden chain on his neck and shall rule as one of three in the kingdom." The idea of ruling as one of three is something we're going to see next week, which is a practice that they had where the king would appoint three people who would be the main governors of the empire. The king didn't have to deal with everything. He had a hierarchy of officers, and there were three people in particular who were administrators beneath him. I'm going to make him one of the three administrators. You sort of wonder if this has any relationship whatsoever to what the Greeks did with the post-Alexander Empire, you know, dividing it up into the three parts. I wonder if that's any relation to this. In this case, it's not breaking up the empire, though. It's simply that he has three people who are in charge. So this is fascinating to me. Yeah?
This takes place a long time after Joseph.
Yes. Quite a long time. In what sense?
He's going to read what the...
What's the major difference between the Joseph story and this one?
One was a dream. One was supposed to be in front of you.
Bingo. One of them was a dream, and one of them is a hand emerging and writing on the wall. What is the difference between those two? How does this method of communication differ from the dream method?
We all have to see hands writing on the wall.
Right. This is a little more clearly supernatural. Yeah. What else?
People can see too.
Other people can see it. It's public. Right? It's more concrete. It is public. What is the point of doing it in this more public way?
So that God's in church.
In other words, that they should all see.
They should all see the God.
Could be. What else?
I don't forget he's a drunk king that's seeing this.
Yes, he's wondering if what he's seeing, right? The sorry? There are witnesses. Good. There's something else. You're all correct. But there's something else that's going on. When you send a diplomatic letter to the king, right? When you send a special message to the king, generally speaking, it is sealed, right? You don't do it in public. It's a private message. When you send a public message, what are you doing?
Challenging the king.
Challenging. It's, I think, a little bit also, and there's something like this in the book of Nehemiah as well, there's a sense that it's an insult.
Yes.
Our communication is not intimate. I don't, you know, when God speaks to somebody in the privacy of their dream, right, it's just to them, there's some sense of closeness, there's some sense of intimacy to it. This is out there for everybody to see. It's beneath God to communicate with him in a direct and personal way. One other note that's fascinating to me on this, and there are a few other things that we're going to see about this. There's more to be said. But the did you notice what his tactic was for trying to get someone to explain his vision? What does he offer? Right. Contrast that with his father, grandfather, predecessor, King Nebuchadnezzar. What's Nebuchadnezzar's method of getting people to go along? Right. I'm going to have you torn into pieces. He does promise wealth also. Let's not forget, he does promise wealth. But, yeah.
It also shows that he takes it seriously. It's worth it to him.
Okay, it shows that he takes it seriously. This is true. But I think there's something to be seen here in the fact that he's not threatening people. He's pleading with people. Yeah? He's scared. Very scared. Okay. And Nebuchadnezzar was scared too, you know. Take a look at the passage now. Let's see what happens. We've seen that there's writing on the wall. He doesn't understand it. We're going to come back to what the writing actually looked like and why it was that he couldn't understand it. But first, Daniel is summoned, but not directly. Then all the king's wise men came. We're in the second paragraph on this page. Then all the king's wise men came, but they could not read the writing or make known its meaning to the king. King Belshazzar grew exceedingly alarmed, and his face darkened, and his nobles were dismayed. Because of the state of the king and his nobles, the queen came to the banquet hall. Now the queen shows up, right? Ahasuerus didn't have Vashti at the party either. The queen is now here. The queen spoke up and said, "O king, live forever!" Because that's, again, how you begin. "Let your thoughts not alarm you or your face darken. There is a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In your father's time, illumination, understanding, and wisdom like that of the gods were to be found in him. And your father, King Nebuchadnezzar, appointed him chief of the magicians, exorcists, Chaldeans, and diviners. Seeing that there is to be found in Daniel, whom the king called Belshazzar, extraordinary spirit, knowledge, and understanding to interpret dreams, to explain riddles, and solve problems, let Daniel now be called to tell the meaning of the writing." And in fact, that's what they do. They summon Daniel. But before we get to the conversation between Daniel and the king, what do you see in the fact that he doesn't know about Daniel? That not that many years have passed. Even if we take the view that Belshazzar was the grandson, right? Which is what the Talmud embraced with this Evel Merodach idea. Right? Let's say he's grandson, though, and not brother of Evel Merodach. It's only been 23 years since somebody survived the king's court, managed to explain dreams, became somebody in charge of great the elements of the kingdom. his friends survive the fiery furnace. The lion's den hasn't happened yet. That's happening next week. We're not there yet. So Diane says, a new pharaoh arises who doesn't know Joseph. However, first of all, that Joseph... Well, no, you could say he also, he explained dreams. I take that back. However, do we assume that he really doesn't know Joseph, or that he chooses not to know Joseph? Right? Exactly. He says, Joseph? I don't know anything. We don't know anything to any Joseph.
Well, we see that here, too, because Belshazzar, he takes, if you go to 3, he says, he takes out the vessels which Nebuchadnezzar had plundered and had not made use of and had not put in his own temple. He says, my grandfather had this stuff in the closet. They left it there. And this is the grandfather, don't forget, who only a chapter before gave kavod to God for having been better than his own God, Zuh.
Yes.
Right? So Belshazzar says, that's my grandfather. What did he know? He kept this stuff in the closet. I'm taking it out. I'm drinking from it. So not only is he dissing God, but he's dissing his grandfather.
Yes.
Which he continues to do in this part of the chapter here, where he's forgotten all about his grandfather. He's forgotten about this guy named Daniel who used to be his grandfather's helper, which is like Joseph and the Pharaoh's helper. And he's sort of like, I'm the big shot now. I don't do things like my grandfather does, and that'll threaten you. I just give you the nice good stuff. I'm not my grandfather. I'm somebody better.
So you think he's trying to make his mark and doing things his own way? Well, it's not working. But I would note just in terms of the Pharaoh point, at least with the Pharaoh, Joseph is already dead. Meaning before that we're told Joseph and all of his brothers are dead. Daniel's alive and kicking, as we're about to find out. So it's really strange.
I'm thinking that the queen might be his mother rather than his wife.
Good. So that's indeed one approach. That's one approach which we're going to come back to, is that this is actually not the queen, but the queen mother. There is such an approach here. So take a look at what happens. Daniel was then brought before the king. The king addressed Daniel. You are Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah. I have heard about you that you have the spirit of the gods in you, and that illumination, knowledge, and extraordinary wisdom are to be found in you. Now the wise men and exorcists have been brought before me to read this writing and to make known its meaning to me, but they could not tell what it meant. I have heard about you that you can give interpretations and solve problems. Now if you can read the writing and make known its meaning to me, you shall be clothed in purple and wear a golden chain on your neck and rule as one of three in the kingdom. Makes the offer. Then Daniel said in reply to the king, you may keep your gifts for yourself and give your presents to others, but I will read the writing for the king and make its meaning known to him. O king, the Most High God bestowed kingship, grandeur, glory, and majesty upon your father Nebuchadnezzar. And because of the grandeur that he bestowed upon him, all the peoples and nations of every language trembled in fear of him. He put to death whom he wished, and whom he wished he let live. He raised high whom he wished, and whom he wished he brought low. But when he grew haughty and willfully presumptuous, he was deposed from his royal throne, and his glory was removed from him. He was driven away from men, and his mind was made like that of a beast, and his habitation was with wild donkeys. He was fed grass like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven, until he came to know that the Most High God is sovereign over the realm of man, and sets over it whom he wishes. But you, Belshazzar, his son, did not humble yourself, although you knew all this. You exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven and had the vessels of his temple brought to you. You and your nobles, your consorts, your concubines drank wine from them and praised the gods of silver and gold, bronze and iron, wood and stone, which you do not see, hear, or understand. But the God who controls your life breath and every move you make, him you did not glorify. He therefore made the hand appear and caused the writing to be inscribed. This is the writing that is inscribed. Mene, take out, Upharsin. That explains everything. Mene, take out, Upharsin. And this is the meaning. Mene is to count. The word minyan from the same root. God has... So that's where we're coming. We're getting there. Good question. God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. And it actually says Mene twice. It's Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. So God has numbered. Tekel. Tekel is like shekel. It's Aramaic. The tough in the Aramaic is a substitute for the shin in Hebrew. Tekel is shekel. Shekel, of course, we think of as a coin, but originally it's a weight. Lishkol is to weigh. Mishkal are weights. It was a weight of metal originally. So, tekel, you have been weighed in the balance and found wanting. And then parson is fascinating. On the one hand, it is lifros, which means to split. When the Torah talks about the kosher animals and mentions the split hooves, mafris parsa, but lifros, haras, is also Persia. It's the Persians. Same word, same spelling. Your kingdom has been divided, the splitting, and given to the Medes and the Persians. That's the explanation that he gives to Belshazzar. Okay, pause there for a moment. Why couldn't they read this? It's in Aramaic. That's their language. Like, why couldn't you read this? So the Josephus, and this isn't probably Josephus, Abarbanel, Dan Isaac Abarbanel quotes a book Josephus. However, he might be quoting Yosifon, which is not the original Josephus. It's a later work. And it could be that that was what he was quoting, which is why I couldn't find it in Josephus. What he suggests is, it's written in Hebrew letters, but the words are Aramaic. Now, what that means is the following. There's an alphabet which is called Paleo-Hebrew. What it means is older Hebrew. It's a different Hebrew alphabet from the one that we are familiar with today. The Hebrew alphabet, hang on, Paleo-Hebrew. The Hebrew that we have today is called in the Talmud Ashurit, Assyrian, and it is commonly understood that it was actually an alphabet that we accepted upon ourselves a little bit after this story. Usually it's associated with Ezra, which is the beginning of the Second Temple period, that he's the one who actually switches the alphabet that we're using. Before that, we have this older alphabet, which is a Canaanite alphabet, which is the one that he's thinking of as Hebrew. So in other words, what that means is, Abarbanel believes, that this is written in Aramaic words, but it's using a different alphabet, and therefore they can't read it. Which Daniel, on the other hand, is able to read. The big question, of course, you have to ask is, if God wants to send him a message, why not write it in an alphabet that he's able to read? Right. So maybe it's for the sake of Daniel. Maybe it's for the sake of Daniel. I actually think something else is going on, which we're going to come back to. I think there's another point that's being made. The Talmud, though, does not assume that this is the case, that it's written in a different font, so to speak, that it's written in a different alphabet. The Talmud believes that actually what happens is God writes it in code. And there are all sorts of suggestions as to what code it is. If you take a look at source number 7, I brought it in the Hebrew because doing it in the English would not have made any sense. Rav says, "Bigematria ichtiv lo," and it's written with gematria. Gematria does not mean what people usually call gematria today, which is associating a number with each letter of the Hebrew alphabet. What it means is another system of scrambling the letters. So Rav says it's written yitat yitat idach pukhamt. What in the world is he talking about? So, what he's talking about is a type of code which is called Atbash. Atbash means At Aleph Taf. Aleph is the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. Taf is the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet. You do a swap. Whenever the first letter should appear, you use the last letter. Whenever the last letter should appear, you do the first letter. And you work your way inward in pairs. So Bet, the second letter of the Hebrew alphabet, is swapped for Shin, the next to last letter in the Hebrew alphabet. Gimel is the third letter. It will be swapped with Resh. And so on, because it's an even number of letters. It's 22 letters. So you have 11 pairs. I gave it to you in number 8. In two rows. First Aleph to Kaf, and then, working backward, Lamed to Taf. So what Rav says is, that's the code that was used. So the Mem, Mene, was actually the Yud. You see? And the Nun, right, working your way there, is the Tet. So he says it's the Atbash code. Shmuel says, Sorry? It's still Mene Mene Tekel Upharsin. It's just that it was written in code, and therefore they didn't know. Had they seen the words Mene Mene Tekel Upharsin, they would have known what it meant.
But instead it says, you test, you test.
Exactly. So that's why they couldn't, that's why they were not able to read it. That's the idea. That's one approach. Second approach comes from the sage Shmuel. And he gives another another explanation. He says, and I brought it for you in number 9, that the letters are actually written vertically. Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin is actually written in columns. But the Babylonian, the Babylonians don't realize that, and they're trying to read it, Mamtus, Ninkifi, they don't know what he's talking about. It's written vertically. If you ever get a chance to look at Rembrandt's painting, Belshazzar's Feast, he shows the writing on the wall, he takes Shmuel's view. He has the letters written vertically. They, in Hebrew, he uses modern Hebrew letters.
That's where Chinese comes from.
Probably not, but it's a nice idea anyway.
Go to Rembrandt's house. He lived in the Jewish quarter of Amsterdam.
Yeah. Interesting. I didn't realize he lived in the Jewish quarter. And we know that he has a lot of... Yeah. Somewhere or other, he picks up Shmuel's way to do this. Just to finish the other two from the Talmud. Rabbi Yochanan, you can figure out, if you can read Hebrew, you can figure it out. The words are written backwards. Right? If you go back to number 7, it's just each word has the letters reversed. And Rav Ashi has some version of Pig Latin. So it's just that the first two letters in each one is swapped. The mem and the nun, the mem and the nun, the tuf and the kuf, and then the vav and the pei. It's child's play, except that if you don't know what sifra is being used, you can't figure out what this is. Eddie? Yes?
Also, we read here that story of the queen and Daniel and all this. This is actually written in the book?
Yes. No, all this is in the book. Right there in the book. So, Mene Mene, right? God is counting, it says, twice. Abarbanel says it's the end of the count for Babylonian destruction, as well as the count for the Jews being redeemed. You could also say it's twice because God is saying, I'm serious, I'm going to carry this out, like Paro, where Paro has the dream twice. And Joseph says to him, it's appearing to you twice to say God is ready to carry this out. And Parson, again, your kingdom is going to be split, and the Persians are going to take over. And now go back to source number 6, the end of it. Then at Belshazzar's command, they clothed Daniel in purple, placed a golden chain on his neck, and proclaimed he should rule as one of three in the kingdom. In other words, he carried it out. Even though Daniel had declined, he says, no, I'm going to do it, and he does it that day. How do we know he did it that day? Next sentence. That very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed. I think I mentioned in one of the earlier weeks, Chaldean technically is not identical with Babylonians, but in general, in Tanakh, we identify them together. It's not different enough for it to be an issue. So they use them interchangeably. And then, of course, Cyrus, the Persian king, returns the vessels of the temple, which, after this story, probably looks like a good idea. Okay, so what are we supposed to get out of this story besides something amusing? So, the first clue is the drinking. Tanakh, in general, views drinking as a sign of disgrace and a sign of poor character, and I want to be really careful with this. I don't mean to malign anyone who has an alcohol problem. That's not the point here. But the Talmud views drinking as a sign of disgrace and a sign of a problem, in fact. I mean, the first example of drinking that we find biblically is? Noah. Right? You get Lot as well, but Noah is earlier. He gets drunk and he's exposed in his tent. Then you have the story of Lot and his daughters. You have the Nazir who wants to do something right. He takes a vow for God and he swears off wine, whether one is supposed to become a Nazir or not. It's clearly seen as a gesture of separating from something that is dangerous or bad. Hannah goes to pray at the temple and Eli, the high priest, rebukes her because he thinks that she is drunk. Ahasuerus, at his feasts, brings out the wine, both the major feasts in the beginning and then the subsequent feasts in the course of the book. We have biblical law that prohibits one who has had a drink from entering into the temple. All sorts of moralizing goes on biblically. I didn't bring the verses here. There are too many of them. But it speaks about people erring with their wine, about wine being treacherous. King Solomon's mother, in the beginning of the 31st chapter of Proverbs, rebukes him not to go after wine. Wine is inappropriate for kings and rulers. Yeah, exactly. But that's the problem. But hang on. Diane mentions the fact that there is a proliferation of what are called in the vernacular Kiddush clubs. Sandy points out the fact that we use drink ritually. And indeed, when you're dealing with wine, what you're dealing with is a double-edged sword. Because on the one hand, it's acknowledged biblically, it can bring joy to a person. It can elevate one's feelings, and at the same time, it can be horribly devastating. And the biblical solution, which becomes part of halacha, part of law, is to try to use it, but in a very confined way, with a lot of warnings against its abuse.
And then there's Purim.
Hang on. Sorry? El Mabasa Riyayim, meat and wine. Yeah. It's understood that it has that effect. Correct.
We're told to have it.
And Ricky makes the point as well regarding Purim, that it becomes part of the celebration, although there it's specifically to distinguish the celebration you're having from the celebration that Ahasuerus has in it. But it's absolutely recognized as something of a threat. Take a look at source number 10. Passage at the end of the volume of Brachot in the Talmud, where they're dealing with dreams and what the imagery means in a dream. Dreams of all kinds of beverages are good signs, except wine. Some drink it and it's good for them, as in the verse, and wine which gladdens the heart of man, Yain Nesamach L'Vavenosh, and some drink it and it's bad for them. And this is from Bathsheba's advice to her son Solomon, give intoxicating drink to the doomed, and wine to those of bitter spirit, meaning that's who should be drinking wine. Wine is not something that one should drink in general. There's a great play on words in another passage in the Talmud, which I brought you in source number 11. Why is wine called both Yayin and Tirosh? Those are both biblical names for wine. Yayin, because it brings yilala, which is wailing to the world. If you think of the word ululating, yes, that's where it comes from. I assume that it comes from yilala. It means to wail. Tirosh, because of the word rosh, not rosh like head. It's resh vavshin. It means rush, one who is poor. One who starts with it becomes poor. And then they also note the verse that we quoted in the previous source, wine which gladdens the heart of man, Yisamach levav enosh. So you could also read it as yishmach, because of course the shin and the sin are the same letter. There are no dots in original biblical text. So it's written yishmach and pronounced yisamach. What does that mean? If one merits, it gladdens him. Yisamach, make him happy. Sameach. If one does not merit, it destroys him. And they read it as yishmach, like shemama, desolation. Interestingly, source number 12 brings this as a source for the practice of saying savri. Right? When someone makes kiddush, there's a part where they're supposed to say savri maranan. It's not part of the blessing. Savri maranan literally means think or pay attention to those who are assembled. And then often people will respond, l'chaim. So there are various explanations for why one does that. I brought you the students of Rashi and their idea. Because wine causes shame, bringing people to intoxication, foolishness, and ruin. And the text says wine is misameach the heart of man, and then you get a version of what we just read in the Talmud in number 11. You find it here. If one merits, it gladdens him. If one does not merit, it destroys him. Therefore, one says, think, my masters, savri maranan, as if to say, set your minds to drink wine. He says it out of fear, lest they come to corruption. And this is why he says, l'chaim, meaning we wish and plan to drink to life. In other words, this drinking should be a positive drinking, not a negative drinking. And lest they come to corruption, they answer, amen, l'chaim. So it's meant to be a statement against damaging drinking. Right, so they would say Amen other than that. Remember that not everybody uses Amen only after a bracha. I mean, there's more to be said about that. But yes, they're saying Amen l'chaim. And Maimonides in number 13, I actually brought you from his work of law. In his Guide to the Perplexed, he's even stronger. But I brought you the one in his work of law because I felt it was okay to go without the strongest formulation. But he says, when a wise person drinks wine, he drinks only enough to irrigate the food in his innards. Anyone who becomes intoxicated is a sinner, degraded, destructive to his own wisdom. Becoming intoxicated in front of laity desecrates God's name, meaning if he's a scholar, it adds to the desecration involved. He writes about this at length. He's not a fan. I ask you to keep all of this in mind because now we're looking at Belshazzar, who drinks with his 1,000 men and understands the way that the rabbis would then look at this kind of a depiction. He is looked at as being degraded. That's number one. Number two, he's holding this big feast in mid-war. Right? Which, again, I've been reading as a morale booster.
We haven't talked about the siege. There's probably not much food. So here he is drinking.
Right. I don't know how much food they had. It's a good question.
You know, and probably the common people did not have any wine. I mean, here he is showing off in a way that's hurting.
Right. And that could be as well. It could be that with the siege, that adds dimension. I hadn't thought about it, but you're right. That's that adds a dimension to it. I saw a hand in this area, but I don't remember. Stephen. So, as I already said, your drinking on Purim is meant to reflect what Ahasuerus did with his celebrations, but not to descend as he did in his celebrations. There's more to be said about wine on Purim. I am an advocate, and I send out an email to this effect every year to the Beit Midrash email list. I'm a believer in the idea that that one drinks a little more than one would normally drink, let's say at one's Shabbat dinner, and take a nap. Not go beyond that. But that's a longer discussion. The third clue to Belshazzar and the way we're supposed to look at him is his use of the temple vessels. It is common biblically to take religious trophies. We did it. After the war that we fought against Shechem, Shimon and Levi's war against Shechem, Jacob has to tell his family, get rid of the gods of Shechem that you took in the spoils. So clearly there was such a practice. King David did it against Ammon as well. He took the crown of their god and had its idolatrous status eliminated, had it rejected as an idol, and then he took it as his own crown. He wore it on his own head. The Mesheh Stele from the 9th century before the Common Era has the Moabites bring the vessels they took from our Mishkan, from our sanctuary, and bring them before their god Chemosh. The Moabite king Mesha records that he did this. And Nebuchadnezzar takes, the Philistines took the ark of God and they put it with their god Dagon. And Nebuchadnezzar took our vessels and put them into his temple. But what you see is something very important. It's different between what Belshazzar did and what others did. All the others before take the vessel of this god they've defeated, right, and say it's a statement of our victory, and they put this vessel, whatever it is, in the temple of their gods, which, even if it's meant to show victory, it's a lot better than using it for drinking at your party. Belshazzar is not Nebuchadnezzar. Belshazzar is not the man his father or grandfather was. And he's being presented as being degraded. And fascinatingly, the Talmud actually notes, I didn't bring it on the sheet, that Ahasuerus does the same thing. Because he is the Persian Belshazzar. He has the same drinking tendency. And he has this conduct as well. There's more to say about Ahasuerus and these vessels, but that's a side note. Diane, I'm going to ask you to hold it for a minute because I've got a lot to get done here. Okay, thank you. So your third clue to his character is his degrading use of the temple vessels. And then the fourth clue is he doesn't know Daniel. Ibn Ezra is the one who suggests that it's the queen mother, as opposed to being the queen. Abarbanel, though, thinks that no, this actually is the queen, which is what it sounds like from the text. And he doesn't know. He doesn't know about Daniel, may testify to his inadequacy for this role. He is the king's son, or the grandson, whatever it is, but he's not serious. He doesn't get involved in this stuff. This is something he just fell into this role because his father passed away and now he's got the throne. But he's completely incompetent in this position. And then finally, he pleads and he bribes. Right? Nebuchadnezzar. I brought it for you. No, I didn't bring it for you, but we read it in a previous week. The Nebuchadnezzar threatens people and they quake. This one has to plead and bribe. But now we... And he's quaking. But Nebuchadnezzar quaked also, let's be fair. But now we come back to the writing on the wall. And I think that there's something going on here. I asked you before, why does God switch? He always used dreams. He communicated with Pharaoh with dreams. He communicated with Nebuchadnezzar with dreams. He communicated with Abimelech, the Philistine king, with dreams. Now he switches. And I think part of it is that it's public. This is a message for everybody. Part of it is to say, I'm putting you at arm's length. I don't deal with you intimately like I did with these others. But I think it also exposes Belshazzar as illiterate in a text that he's supposed to be able to read. You know, it's a statement here. I'm putting the writing on the wall by the lamp, right? In case you missed that, right? By the lamp, there's plenty of light. You should be able to read it. And he's exposing him as somebody who is totally beneath God and beneath God's notice. And I'm going to put the message out there, and he's not going to be able to read it.
He did it in quote anyway.
Right, so that's the point. Make sure he can't read it. But take a look at source number 15.
But it's
an explanation of why he wouldn't be able to. He's not literally illiterate. God is mocking him as illiterate. That's the idea. But take a look at source number 15 from the end of the Chumash. Moses is predicting for the Jews what's going to happen to them when they stray from God. And God is described as saying, they, the Jews, outraged me with a non-God, lo-el, causing me anger with their emptiness. I will outrage them with a, it should say, this is a mistake in my translation, and it's the most important word. I will outrage them with a non-nation. With a disgusting nation, I will anger them. They sinned against me with a non-God. I'm going to come back to them with a non-nation. Which one is this referring to? So the first one it could refer to would be Babylon. Usually, the commentators like to take this and apply it to Rome, because Rome as an empire was so scattered that it's sort of a non-nation. But the first one would be Babylon. And what he's saying is, they don't really rank. They don't have substance. The same way the idols are not a god, Babylon is not really a nation. They're not worthy. And they angered me with their empty gods, so I'm going to bring a goy naval, a disgusting nation, and that's Belshazzar. He is the one who is considered to be beneath notice. God has no interest in such a person other than as a means of punishing the Jews when they stray. That's it.
1,000 years before.
Yeah, this is called Nevuah. This is the prophecy of what's going to happen. The final clue in all of this is Daniel's refusal of the gifts. Daniel accepted gifts from Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar gave Daniel gifts for interpreting his dreams and giving him advice and all of that. And Daniel accepted it. But he refuses them now. So Don Isaac Abarbanel thinks that Daniel refuses the gifts because he wants to rebuke him. You know, he wants to give him a harsh rebuke. But, you know, he rebuked Nebuchadnezzar also regarding this whole business of him becoming a tree and that whole message he gave him. You could say that the difference is because the gift is offered here before the prophecy. Nebuchadnezzar only offered him the gift after the prophecy. So maybe Daniel refuses the gift because he wants to show, I'm not biased by your offer. I'm not doing it for pay. That could be. But I think what's going on here is that the relationship between Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar is substantively different. With Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel accepted gifts. With Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel said to him, "May this evil befall your enemies," right? However we understood who his enemies were. With Nebuchadnezzar, he offered him advice to delay the fall. He said, "Give tzedakah and then this won't happen to you." And with Nebuchadnezzar, he invoked and credited God at the start of his advice. Right? He said, "All of this comes from God," and all. You don't find that in this chapter. He doesn't say God has interpretations and so on. He doesn't mention God. And I'm building on an idea from Rabbi Yaakov Meidan when I suggest that Belshazzar simply doesn't have Daniel's respect. He's a drunk. He parties with his friends to build morale. He treats the temple vessels with disrespect. He's politically illiterate. He is a frightened people pleaser. God keeps him at a remove and humiliates him by showing him to be unable to explain the writing on the wall. And if you think of the biblical story of Abraham and the king of Sidon, right? Do you remember the story? Abraham has run-ins with different kings. He has run-ins with the Pharaoh, and the Pharaoh offers him gifts, and he takes it. Abimelech also, the Philistine king, and he takes it. However, there's one war, the war that Abraham fights to save his brother-in-law Lot. Right? Sarah's brother is taken captive by this association of four kings, and Abraham goes to war, defeats those kings, saves Lot, and then out comes the king of the city of Sodom. And he says to him, "Thank you so much for what you've done." Abram had liberated him. And he says to him, "Let's make a deal. I'm going to take the captives, and you take the spoils." Which is a big deal. The king of Sodom is known for its greed. He says, "You can take the spoils." And Abram says, "I don't want you to be able to say that you gave me anything." That's what he says. "V'al tomar ani hesharti et Avram." I don't want you going around telling people you gave me anything. The Sodom is beneath Abraham. And I think that's what's going on here. Daniel says, I'm not taking anything from you. You can keep your gifts. And of course, in the end, Belshazzar tries to give it to him anyway, but it's useless because that night he's killed and the empire is over. But I think that may be the statement that's going on. And what the story gives us, aside from an interesting historical lesson about Belshazzar and Daniel and the end of the Babylonian Empire, is guidance in terms of who is respected and who is not respected, what sort of conduct the Torah respects and what sort of conduct the Torah does not respect. And what Belshazzar does, and in particular the drinking, is something that the Torah does not respect. We continue, God willing, next week with our last in the series, Darius and Daniel and the Lion's Den. Stay tuned. Thank you. Right, and the answer is we don't know anything about her, other than what you see here in the story. I would have assumed, again, like we said initially with him, everybody should know about Daniel. It's bizarre that he's unaware. Yeah, we do find Daniel later on living in the city of Shushan, and one of the commentators suggests that maybe he's already living in Shushan, which is far away, even if it's under Babylonian control, but it just doesn't explain how this person can't be aware of Daniel.
Maybe he doesn't want to give him import by saying, "Well, I don't know if he does or don't."
Maybe, but then he calls for him when the queen mentions him.
Well, now he has to.
Maybe now he has.